ABC Radio.
You're listening to Nightlife.
Nightlife with Philip Clark.
Joining us tonight, an exceptional guest, Brian Green, who heads up Columbia University's Centre for Theoretical Physics. He's authored six books, from the first bestseller, The Elegant Universe, to his latest, Until the End of Time. And collectively, his books have sold over 2 million copies worldwide and spent weeks and weeks on the New York Times bestseller lists. He's made major discoveries in physics around string and superstring theories. Also, a great explainer of concepts. Indeed, the Washington Post has hailed him as the single best explainer of abstruse concepts in the world today. That's a big label. He's currently touring live shows in Australasia, and I'm pleased to say he joins us this evening. Brian, good evening, and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you with us, too. Can we start with the Big Bang? I know that's where everyone wants to start with, because people have co-opted it in all sorts of ways. What's the current thinking about what the Big Bang was?
Well, the first answer is it's deeply mysterious, even to people at the cutting edge of research. So there isn't an answer that everybody can say, that's it. That's what powered the Big Bang. That's why there was a Big Bang. But physicists are nothing if not creative. Hmm. And the most compelling idea today goes under the heading of something called inflationary cosmology, you know, nothing to do with the economic version of that term. Rather, we realized that with Einstein's description of gravity, gravity can be both attractive, the kind that we're familiar with on planet Earth. You drop things and it falls to the Earth because the Earth and the object are attracted to each other by gravity. But there is a more exotic version of gravity that comes out of Einstein's thinking, which is a repulsive version of gravity, a gravity that pushes outward, doesn't pull inward. And so the idea is that in the very early universe, there was a cosmic fuel that gave rise to this repulsive version of gravity. And because it pushed outward, it drove everything apart in a rapid swelling that we call the Big Bang. And that may be why there was a Big Bang in the first place.
Hmm. What was there at the Big Bang? Do we have a concept of this? I think a lot of people in popular thought think, oh, well, there was, you know, there was a piece of matter which exploded or something of that nature. What do we think was, what was there at the Big Bang to expand?
It's a great question. And the most conventional answer is that space and time themselves came into existence with the Big Bang. So there wasn't sort of some pre-existing realm of space within which the Big Bang took place. Rather, there was nothing, no expanse of space, no previous moment of time. And from that very strange and hard to wrap your mind around beginning, the universe expanded. And as it expanded, space itself came into existence. And as space expanded, it stretched, making more space, ultimately giving rise to the grand expanse of the spatial and temporal cosmos that we now inhabit and we now witness. So that's the most conventional way of thinking about it. But I should say that as research has progressed, people have imagined other possibilities that maybe the Big Bang was not really the beginning of everything. Maybe the Big Bang was the beginning of our realm of reality, but maybe there were other Big Bangs giving rise to other realms of reality, other universes, so to speak. So maybe before our bang happened, there were previous bangs giving rise to other universes. And so maybe we're part of a multiverse, an idea that certainly Hollywood has latched onto with vigor lately. But it's highly speculative. It's not like we know that this to be true, but that's a competing idea that people take seriously.
Mm. Yes, the film, as you alluded to, Everything Everywhere All at Once, won a bag full of Oscars, and it draws on this idea that the universe is just one of an infinite number of universes.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you say this is an idea, it is just an idea, isn't it? There is no evidence for this.
There is no evidence right now for other universes beyond our own. It's just indirect mathematical suggestions. You know, that's what we theoretical physicists do. We take note of observations. And so the Big Bang is a theory that makes predictions for things that we should see with telescopes. Mm. And we look out into deep space, we pretty much see what the mathematics says that we should see. And that gives us confidence that the math is a good guide. But then when the math also says, hey, maybe there are other universes and we don't see them, we don't dismiss it out of hand because the math has done such a good job so far. And so we do take seriously predictions or ideas that come out of the mathematics, even if we haven't yet seen evidence for them.
So in this, let's stay with our own universe for a bit before we speculate about the multis. In our own universe, where does matter come from then? Is it always only present at the Big Bang and all the matter in the universe was contained within that initial inflationary event? Or is there some other thinking?
No, we don't think so. Certainly one of the beautiful things about one of Einstein's other insights is that E equals mc squared. Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. It's the most famous of all equations. And in essence, what it really says is that energy and matter are kind of interchangeable. So you don't have to have all the matter in the universe back there at the beginning, because rather than it taking the form of electrons and protons and things that we're familiar with, it can take the form of a kind of pure energy that later on can transmute into the particles of matter. And beyond that, the beautiful thing in this inflationary approach is you don't have to even start with all the energy necessary to create all the matter in the universe, because all you need is a little bit of energy to drive the outward swelling of space. And as space swells, it actually creates more space and more energy filling space. It's a kind of ultimate free lunch, is how some of us in the field are fond of describing it. And so to tell you the truth, all you need is something like, you know, less than a pound, less than a kilo, let's say, of this initial energy in the inflaton fuel. And over the course of the expanding of space, that initial kilo creates enough energy to ultimately create all the matter that we see. So the matter's not actually there at the beginning. It's just this fuel that has enough energy to get the process going.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Professor Brian Green, a theoretical physicist, a mathematician. He's also a string theorist. We'll get to that in a moment. But a great explainer of some of the most difficult concepts, I think, that we wrestle with. Of course, most people also, their next question, once they've thought about the Big Bang and the universe, they, well, yes, what came before the Big Bang? And I've spoken to physicists before who say that's not a sensible question because there wasn't anything. In other words, there was no thing to think about. How would you put it?
Well, it kind of gestures back to what we were speaking about just a moment ago. There are two possible answers, one of which is the one that you just recounted. And maybe I can just flesh that out for a moment. You know, it could be that time starts with the bang. And so using the term before there was any time would not be a sensible thing. And that's what these physicists are saying. And an analogy that I think captures that strange idea is, look, if you're on planet Earth and you ask someone what direction is north, they can point you northward, and you keep on walking, you pass somebody else, ask them, and they point you further north. But when you get to the North Pole itself and you say to somebody there, how do I go further north than the North Pole? They say that's a nonsensical question. You can't go further north than the North Pole. The North Pole is where the concept of north begins. And so that idea could apply to time, in that you can imagine going back 100 years, a billion years, 10 billion years. But when you go right back to the beginning of time, the notion of going further back in time would be as nonsensical as going further north than the North Pole. So that's one way, and that may be the answer. But again, if we reflect on these more exotic ideas, like this possibility of a multiverse that we mentioned before, then there might be a before the Big Bang, because there might have been other bangs yielding other universes before our Big Bang. So our Big Bang might not be the start. It might just be an interesting event that starts our part of the cosmos, but not the entirety, in which case the notion of before might make sense.
When we think about the universe, I suspect most people think of it as something like a giant balloon that's constantly getting bigger because we're told it's expanding. Although we now learn that science are telling us that, of course, well, it is expanding, but everything's expanding from each other at the same time. In other words, it's constantly expanding all over the place, all over the balloon, not from one central point, which a balloon essentially does when you put air into it. What shape is the universe?
Well, actually, the analogy of a balloon is pretty good if you don't fall into the trap that your description seems to make reference to. When we talk about the expanding balloon, we are saying to ourselves, ignore everything but the rubber surface of the balloon. Forget about that central point. Forget about any point that's not on the surface itself. And from that perspective, if you're a little ant sitting on this expanding piece of rubber, then every location is rushing away from you. And if you move your location to some other point on the surface of the balloon, then even from that vantage point, as the balloon stretches, every point is rushing away from you. So it does hold water. That's a relatively good way of thinking about the expansion of space. But your question is that shape overall the correct shape of space? Is the universe kind of spherical in its shape? Now, it could be. It could be a sphere, a higher dimensional version, because after all, the surface of a balloon only has two dimensions, you know, latitude and longitude, if you will. So there are generalizations of the surface of a balloon that are spherical, that have three dimensions. They're hard to picture, but they exist mathematically, and that could be the shape of our universe. But it could also be that our universe is more like a flat tabletop that's stretching in all directions. Again, the three-dimensional version of that surface. Or the shape of our universe could be kind of like a Pringles potato chip, kind of like a saddle shape in which it's not bulging outward like the balloon, but kind of falling in on itself the way a Pringles shape does. So those are the three dominant shapes that people talk about, because mathematically they have a great deal of symmetry, and we believe the universe does indeed have that kind of symmetry. But the bottom line is we don't know the overall shape of space, because we can only observe the part of the universe from which light could have as yet reached us since the Big Bang. And that's, you know, just some number of billions of light years. It's large, but the reality is that space could be much larger than we can see. And so we don't have direct observational insight into the overall shape of the cosmos.
Which leads us to, well, you may have answered this question already, is if it does have a shape, what's outside of it?
Right. So again, the weirdness of cosmology forces you to reorient your thinking based upon everyday life. Because, you know, when you look at a soccer ball, a football, there's the ball, and then there's outside of the ball, the air in the room, the realm of the stadium. When you look at that Pringles potato chip, there's a potato chip, but then there's all the space in the kitchen or the restaurant around that Pringles potato chip. When we talk about these shapes for cosmology, we are saying this is the shape of everything. There is no outside this shape when it comes to the cosmos itself. It's a deeply unfamiliar idea because we never experience it in everyday life. And look, our brains, they evolved in order to survive in the world that we inhabit, and to be able to picture a shape that has nothing outside it didn't have any survival value back on the African savanna hundreds of thousands of years ago. So our forebears didn't have any evolutionary pressure to develop an ability to think about and see and have intuition for the things that we're talking about right here. But the power of the human mind is we've been able to go beyond the things necessary for mere survival and begin to probe deeper truths. And those deeper truths do force us to reorient our thinking in a deeply unfamiliar way.
Brian Green is with us, a theoretical physicist, and we're talking about some simple ideas like where do we come from and what does it all mean. I like these ideas about the shape of the universe. I was listening to you recently speaking about whether the universe could even be some sort of loop, and thinking there's a famous shape, isn't there? I think it's called a Möbius or Möbius strip, where if you start tracing a line around it, there seems to be no inside and outside. There seems to be only one dimension. It's a marvelously simple trick. But
yeah.
You wonder whether there's some of that thinking in the way we should think about the universe. In other words, if you wanted to walk out of the universe to its edge, you could start walking. But once you did start walking, you would never come to an end because there is no end.
That's right. And, you know, the Möbius strip is a particularly exotic version of that, where, as you note, it seems to have two sides to it, but it really only has one because as you traverse it, you wind up covering both of those sides. But the idea of walking out into space and not encountering an edge and kind of circling back to your starting point, that happens with even simpler shapes that are easier to picture. I mean, if you imagine having a big circle, if one of the spatial dimensions of our universe is a big circle, you'd walk out in one direction and you'd wind up circling back and return to your starting point. So imagine that the shape of the universe is kind of like a tin can, like a can of soup. You know, one dimension might go on forever, but the other circles around that shape. And that could easily be the shape that is relevant to our universe. As far as we can tell, nothing rules that out.
Yeah, well, we'll move on to some other concepts in a moment, but just back on the Big Bang itself, one of the other fundamental questions is, well, of course, if this happened, why did it happen? What caused it? What was the button that was pushed, in other words? Can we ever know?
Well, questions like that, of course, are questions that often drive people to imagine some kind of supreme being, some cosmic intelligence, all that stuff, because you feel stymied by the need, it would seem, for some kind of thinking creature to hit that button and say, okay, the time is right. Many of us do not feel that that is necessary, because we can envision a less exotic process where a mindless universe can exist for some grand stretch of time. And I'm even hard-pressed to describe it without invoking a notion of time that may not even be relevant before the Big Bang. So excuse my lack of creative language. So let me just use language that we're familiar with. Imagine that the universe existed for a long period of time in a non-expanding state, because that cosmic fuel that we discussed earlier, that inflaton fuel, hadn't yet coalesced. And imagine that that fuel is kind of meandering around, its value changing for a near eternity. And then just out of sheer chance, just out of the sheer probabilities, for one brief moment, the fuel does coalesce to yield that repulsive gravity. And at that moment, the universe undergoes its rapid expansion and the Big Bang happens. So it could be just a random process that, just like when you play at the casino, for most of the time you don't win, but every so often you will win because the probabilities conspire for you to get the result that we characterize as a win. For most of the universe, it didn't win in the sense there was no Big Bang, but then the sheer probabilities, just like in the casino, demand that if you wait long enough, even a rare configuration of this inflaton will take place. And once that happens, the repulsive gravity drives everything apart and the Big Bang takes off. That's a possibility that doesn't involve some guiding intelligence.
In other words, it's a random event. It has no meaning and oughtn't to be invested with one.
I think that's probably the best way of describing it. Now, having said that, I don't think there's anything wrong with investing meaning in it, so long as you recognize that you're telling yourself a story, a story that may help your life feel deeper and feel more connected and adds richness and poetry to your reality. But when it comes to the way the physics works, the brute force objective reality, no, I don't think there's any built-in meaning or purpose.
Yeah, which it probably stems, do you think, Brian, from the fact that this species of ours, Homo sapiens, and we've been here for, 250,000 years, nothing in the scheme of things. We do think we are the center of the universe, though, and because we observe it, we think, therefore, we must have some more, some greater purpose. We talk about the idea that we are conscious of our surroundings and so on. This idea of consciousness is interesting, isn't it? Does it have any In physics, does it have any description that you could put on it that you could use to describe? Is there a mathematics that describes consciousness?
Not yet. There are proposals. There are certainly some who hail more from the psychological, biological sciences, neuroscience, which have attempted to give some mathematical description of what consciousness is. I'm not convinced by it. I'm glad that people are trying to do that. I consider consciousness to be among the grand mysteries that science has not yet addressed. I mean, to me, it's utterly remarkable that when you take a collection of particles, electrons, yes, protons, neutrons, and you configure them in the right way that we call a human brain, and you animate that with the right electrical activity, that collection of particles becomes aware of itself, has an inner world of sights and sounds and colors and smells and experiences. It's just stupendous that matter can somehow do that, especially given our belief that the ingredients themselves aren't conscious. I don't think an electron is conscious.
No.
I don't think a photon is conscious.
Well, here's the puzzle.
That's right.
Yeah, go on. Here's the puzzle, isn't it? That if we are just particles, we are just particles. So we know that because science can tell us that, and we can do experiments and prove it. We are just particles. Therefore, other things that are just particles, I don't know, the rock in the garden. Why is the rock not conscious? Or could we even know whether it was?
It's very difficult. Frankly, I can't even tell if you're conscious. And I don't mean that, you know, in some derogatory sense. I assume you are based on your behaviors. But since I'm not inside your head, I don't know what's going on inside your mind. You know, I could finish this interview and then someone tells me, hey, you were just talking to ChatGPT-4 or something like that. And I don't think that structure is conscious either. But your question is a really good one. What does distinguish the rock from, say, the human brain, giving one self-awareness we think and the other not self-awareness we think?
We think, yeah.
The answer, the answer seems to be just the level of organization, the level of complex configuration. The rock is pretty simple inside. There isn't a whole lot of detailed organization, not a whole lot of complexity in the way the ingredients of the rock are configured. And yet when you go inside a human brain, great deal of complexity, great deal of coherence, great deal of organized, complex processes that continue to function throughout the lifespan of that object. And that seems to be the difference. When matter attains sufficient organization, sufficient complexity, with sufficient coherence, it acquires the capacity to be self-aware and to have conscious inner sensations. If that happens, I don't think anybody can say, but it's utterly remarkable that it does.
People who own pets would look at their pet and say, well, my dog has consciousness. It's aware of me. It's aware of its surroundings. I've caught the dog looking out the window in a sense of wonder. Could it be, from what you're saying, is that consciousness is on a climb, and humans may experience the highest level of consciousness that we see around us, but that there are levels of consciousness all the way down through the life cycle to an earthworm, for example, which is conscious in a way.
Yes, I agree that consciousness absolutely is a continuum. We see that, as you say, based on a comparison of the animals that we are intimately familiar with and would be hard-pressed to say that they're not conscious. But the question is, does that continuum of consciousness, say, I'm not trying to have human exceptionalism here, but let's put ourselves for the moment at the pinnacle of conscious structures that we are aware of. As we head down to less complex brains and less complex living systems, when we exit life and talk about structures that are inanimate, do they have consciousness? And again, that's a question you asked before. And I said, I don't really know the answer. And I should point out that there are some thinkers, serious thinkers, who think that the continuum does not stop with life, that it goes all the way down to electrons and protons, And it's as if they have a certain kind of proto-consciousness, a little bit of consciousness in each of the particles, in order to explain the mystery of how a lot of particles can have conscious awareness, even if the ingredients don't have consciousness. One answer is the particles do have consciousness, just a little bit. Yeah. And so you need a lot of particles for your goal of having a lot of consciousness. And that's why the human brain has many particles.
Which, of course, I mean, logically, in a sense, you'd think that would have to be so. Why do you suddenly call an endpoint on consciousness? For that matter, too, with humans, why do you put an endpoint where we are, as though we were at the apex of things? You might say, in the universe, there's every possibility that there are higher levels of consciousness somewhere.
Absolutely. I mean, I imagine that when we make contact, I expect we will, with extraterrestrial intelligence, the odds are they're going to be way ahead of us or way behind us, but the odds are not that they're going to be at the same level of development that we are. I mean, just think about the timescales. It took life about 1 billion years to first form on this planet, a few more billion years for intelligent life that we characterize as such to emerge. So the scales are billions of years. And so when we encounter some extraterrestrial civilization, there's absolutely no reason why they would have begun to develop at the same point as we are. And since the scales involved are billions of years, the odds are either they're billions of years behind us, or I think quite likely billions of years ahead of us. And think about how we differ from members of our species even 1,000 or 5,000 years ago. Imagine speaking to someone, you know, from say ancient Greece and showing them your iPhone and describing the general theory of relativity, right? I mean, we have progressed great strides over just a handful of thousands of years. Now imagine millions of thousands of years. That's what a billion years is, right? A thousand million. So imagine that amplified by millions of times. Well, that being is likely to be so different from us that we may not have any means to even communicate or understand them. That's how far apart we could be in terms of our level of conscious awareness.
What do you make of that? So you would be of the view that yes, there are levels of consciousness out there in the universe. What do you make of that? It's got a name, hasn't it? That paradox, which suggests that if there was, then why haven't we seen it?
Well, I think that my way of describing it in terms of the mismatch in levels of development is potentially the answer, right? I mean, how often do you stop to have a conversation with the ants in an anthill? How often have you done that?
Not often, Brian, no.
And the reason for that is presumably you don't think that you and the ants have much to talk about because our level of development is so different. We may be the ants in comparison to intelligent life out there in the cosmos, especially if that intelligent life has cracked the ability to travel intergalactically, which is a huge challenge that we've not really cracked ourselves. They probably are way ahead of us. And in all the destinations that they could put on their itinerary, stopping by meager planet Earth to talk with some ants just is not that interesting. And they're not going to stop to do that. And that may be why they haven't been here.
I think humans too have a problem, don't we, in not regarding ourselves as being tremendously important and having some sort of purpose. And I think you've made the observation that apart from the timescales, which are, of course, immense, and humans have been here for, you know, relatively nanosecond of time, even here on Earth, let alone the universe's timescales. But as I think if you pointed out, too, if it hadn't been for a completely random event 65 million years ago when an asteroid, we think, slammed into the Earth, well, we know, actually, slammed into the Earth and ended life on Earth for the number one apex animal at the time, which was the dinosaur. There were no humans then. Well, there may never have been sophisticated mammals like us that would have emerged, because the dominant life forms on Earth would have been quite different. There's nothing inevitable about mammals, successful conscious mammals like us, suddenly having the position that we have. It's random. It's an accident. It could have it might have happened. It might not have happened. A bit like the universe. It might have been created. It might not have.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Now, I agree with that completely. And I guess one could try to argue, I don't think too convincingly, that maybe the dinosaurs would have evolved a level of intelligence where they would be kicking around quantum mechanics and general relativity and building radio telescopes and trying to communicate with the rest of the universe. But I doubt it. Hmm. I think that things would have not changed all that much from the way they had been for a long stretch of time mm-hmm. before that asteroid slammed into the Yucatan and then wiped out the dinosaurs. So, yes, there's a great deal of contingency in our existence. A whole variety of accidents needed to happen in order for us to be sitting here having this conversation. Now, the mitigating side of that discussion is we now know that just about every star in the galaxy and probably other galaxies too have planets. Hmm. And so the number of planets, I mean, our galaxy alone, hundreds of billions of stars, so hundreds of billions of planets, and then there are hundreds of billions of galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars. So the stupendous number of planets out there in the cosmos means that we've been able to, by we, I mean the universe, has been able to run this experiment over and over and over again. And so depending on how unlikely it is for intelligent life to emerge, maybe it's a small probability, but amplified by a huge number of planets, maybe intelligent life is plentiful. However, if the accidents that you're referring to are so unlikely, so stupendously unlikely, that even with a great number of planets, maybe it hasn't happened often. Maybe it's only happened once. That isn't my intuition, but it's certainly a possibility.
Mm. Indeed. Professor Brian Green's with us, a theoretical physicist. He's a mathematician and string theorist and, a wonderful explainer of these great and fundamental questions about the universe. I think one of the other things that people have struggle with, when I say people, I mean not theoretical physicists, Brian, struggle with is this notion of time being a dimension. Tell us about that. What for most people, I think we think of time as, well, it's measurable. We've got clocks and watches to measure it, and we think that it's a constant. Now, from Einstein's time onwards, we now know that that's not the case, that time is relative, depending where you are and how fast you're going and what you're looking at.
Yeah.
Do we have a really good handle on what time is?
Well, there's sort of, again, multiple layers to that question. The deepest one, which we do not have an answer to, is whether time is somehow intimately woven into the very fabric of reality. Hmm. And therefore, you can't have a universe without time. Or could it be that time is a useful notion that we humans have invented in order to organize our experiences into some coherent narrative? Mm-hmm. First there was this, then there was that, then there was that. To really have a sense of causality, you need to have a sense of time. A was before B and A caused B. That kind of talk can't really exist without a notion of time. So whether or not it's fundamental or we make it up, certainly that is up in the air. In terms of the way time itself behaves, though, the weirdness of time that Einstein showed us, I think we now do understand that quite well. In the era of Isaac Newton, time was universal.
Hmm.
Time elapsed at the same rate for everybody, regardless of where they were, how they were moving, what they were doing. It was as if there was this grand cosmic clock out there ticking forward second by second by second, the same for everybody. Einstein came along and took kind of a sledgehammer to that cosmological clock, that universality of time, and smashed it to pieces because he revealed that time elapses at different rates depending on your relative motion. How fast you and somebody else are moving dictates the relative rate at which your clocks will tick. And he also showed that the rate at which time elapses depends on the gravitational field that you are experiencing. So if you're at the edge of a black hole, time elapses for you much more slowly than it does for someone who's far away from that black hole and not experiencing its gravitational pull quite as strongly. And these are deeply counterintuitive features of time, but these are completely proven experimentally.
Yeah.
We've taken clocks And you don't have to have a black hole. You can put a clock at the surface of the Earth and you can put it up in space. Those two clocks experience different gravitational pulls from Earth, and the clock closer to Earth's surface ticks off time more slowly. We've taken clocks and put them on airplanes, left one on the tarmac at the airport, put one on an airplane and fly it around the world. And you can compare those two clocks. And they do not agree after the journey because they were in relative motion and also experiencing different gravity. So this is really real. Now, the effects in everyday life, like airplanes and distances that are not large and gravity not strong, they're small. We're talking billionths of a second. But that proves Einstein's ideas. And so we're completely confident that if you were near a black hole, time for you would elapse incredibly slowly compared to time for anybody else. And that really gives you a mechanism for time travel.
Mm. Tell me about that, yeah. Because after all, we're familiar with three dimensions, whether something's deep, high, or wide. So we know about all that. But if time is also a dimension, we know we can travel through the three dimensions that we're very familiar with. If time is a dimension as well, then logic would have that we could travel around time as well, although that it doesn't seem to be so simple, does it?
It's not as simple as traveling through space at will, but certainly when it comes to traveling into the future at will, there's an approach that Einstein gave us. The simpler approach is if you build a spaceship that can go a significant fraction of the speed of light, that's the hurdle. But let's assume that technology one day allows us to do that. If you get into that ship and you travel near the speed of light, and let's say you go out into space for 6 months, you turn around and you come back 6 months more, you will have aged 1 year. But compared to clocks on planet Earth, your clock will have been ticking off time relatively slowly. And so clocks on Earth will have elapsed far more than 1 year. When you step out of that ship 1 year older, you will find that the Earth is 1,000 years older or 1,000,000 or 1,000,000,000 years older, all dependent on how close to the speed of light you actually traveled. You will have volitionally traveled into the future of planet Earth. So that is a kind of time travel. It's toward the future. And it shows that, yes, you can navigate space at will. And to some extent, you can navigate time at will as well. Now, the deep question is, can you go back in time?
Yeah,
that's the one that we've not yet ruled out. But I would say most physicists think that it's probably unlikely that you can freely travel back in time. But there are proposals for how to do that.
What's the stumbling block for going back?
Well, the way in which causality works, A causes B, can be brought into question if you can travel into the past. I mean, anybody who's seen a film like Back to the Future, right? What happens in Back to the Future? Marty McFly travels back in time and he kind of almost prevents his parents from meeting. And if he would have prevented his parents from meeting, we face a logical paradox, not a scientific paradox, a logical paradox, because if his parents never met, how was he born? How did he exist to prevent them from meeting? Right. And so the logical consistency of reality would seem to butt up against the possibility of traveling into the past. Now, that doesn't rule out that possibility. It just means that you have to be really careful about the way in which travel to the past can take place. And so some people have suggested that, well, maybe when you travel to the past, you don't have free will. You don't have the ability to change anything. You can try as much as you might want. Maybe you don't want your parents to meet for some reason. Maybe you don't want to exist. But when you go back in time, as much as you try to prevent your parents from meeting, you are unable to do that. That's one possibility. Again, it seems to challenge our intuitive sense that we have freedom of will. But frankly, in another conversation we could have, I don't think we actually do have freedom of will. So I'm a fan of that approach. Another approach is people say, well, maybe when you travel to the past, you go to the past of a parallel universe, another universe, and maybe you prevent your parents from meeting in that universe, but that doesn't challenge your own existence because in the world from which you began, your parents did meet and you travel to the past of a different realm. It's all just to say that there are proposals for how you might travel to the past without ruining the logical consistency of reality, but actually accomplishing it is something that we really don't know how to do.
Mm. That's right, because we know, and this is still a constant, isn't it, that the speed of light is we know because of Einstein's equations that this is it. We can't go faster than that. But also, even accelerating ourselves or anything really to anything remotely achieving the speed of light seems, well, it's not theoretically impossible, or is it?
It's not theoretically impossible. It is technologically challenging to create a ship that can traverse space at the enormous speed of light. You're right. The speed of light, we believe, is the maximum speed limit, and it's a large number. You know, depending on what units you like, 300 million meters per second, you know, 671 million miles per hour. That's fast enough to encircle the entire Earth more than seven times in 1 second, right? Mm. I mean, that's an incredibly fast speed. And so we've been unable to build ships that can achieve that speed, but there doesn't seem to be any law of physics that will get in the way. It's just technology. And so perhaps one day we will achieve that. And if we did, then we would be able to travel through time in these weird ways that we've been describing, at least toward the future.
Mm. Yes. What's the biggest problem? We keep saying that there are, what I love, physicists seem to love acronyms. There's the TOE, the T-O-E, the theory of everything, which they say is the big quest in theoretical physics. That is an idea that would explain everything, that would tie together Einstein's relativity theories with quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics seem to be a kind of weird world in which, normal rules don't apply. Do you think that is the big question, or are we asking the wrong question?
Well, I think it is the big question, and we're asking the wrong question. I would say it's really both. So your description is quite good. Our understanding of Einstein's general relativity describes the big stuffs, because general relativity is a theory of gravity. And so for stars and galaxies and planets, that's where Einstein's ideas really manifest themselves. And quantum mechanics, as you mentioned, is the weird rules that govern the micro realm, the electrons, the quarks, and so forth. And for a long time, those two sets of rules were deeply antagonistic toward each other. Anytime we tried to meld the math of the small, the math of quantum mechanics, with the math of the big, Einstein's general relativity, all hell broke loose. The mathematics just fell apart.
Hmm.
And so string theory was developed starting way back in the 70s, 60s and 70s, to try to fix this problem. And we made a lot of progress in putting the two realms together. But in more recent times, a new way of thinking about this question has emerged, which is why I also said we may be asking somewhat the wrong question, because we've always thought about it as blending the rules of quantum mechanics with the rules of general relativity, kind of pushing them together. There's been recent work suggesting that quantum mechanics and general relativity may actually be the same theory, just in disguise. That the rules of quantum mechanics and general relativity may already be blended together, and it's just a matter of really understanding how that blending works, how it exists, and what it tells us. And so if I was to say that there's a somewhat new movement afoot in trying to build this unified theory that Einstein dreamed of having but never found in his lifetime, the new movement would be recognizing that it's not so much squashing the two sets of rules together, it's really understanding how they're already blended in our current descriptions.
Yes, I hope we get there before we immolate ourselves with current problems. We know that the world is coming to an end anyway, because of the second law of thermodynamics, don't we, Brian? That in the end, it's all going to wind down one way.
Well, it is
one
a question,
way, or the, one way or the other, don't we?
It's a question of timescale. So, you know, when we apply the second law of thermodynamics, this relentless increase in disorder, this relentless increase in entropy that we actually learned about in the 1700s and 1800s at some level, just from studying the functioning of steam engines, of all things. That's really where our thought and description of entropy really began. It feels remarkable that such a prosaic piece of technology would have such a profound impact on our understanding, but that's really what it came from. But when we apply the second law of thermodynamics to the entire cosmos, you're right, it all does ultimately wind down, but the timescales for that winding down are on the order of 10 to the 100 years. We are now 10 to the 10. We're 10 to the 10 years from the Big Bang. And that difference of 90 is in the exponent. So it's not like 90 more years. I mean, a difference of 90 in the exponent is a stupendous amount. And so if that's the timescale at which things really wind down versus our annihilating ourselves, which you make reference to in your self-immolation or annihilation, you know, that could be on the order of, Jesus, days, months, years, decades. I mean, I hope that we smarten up. I hope that somehow we're able to shed the kinds of thinking and behavior that served us well when we were trying to survive in the, you know, early days of our species way back, you know, 50,000, 100,000 years ago, you know, fighting and struggling and beating your opponent may have been the way nature allowed us to prevail. But come on, we're no longer in that circumstance any longer. We're in a circumstance where our behavior need not be guided by mere survival. And we need to get to a place where our behavior catches up with the realm of reality that we have molded for ourselves and the reality that we currently inhabit. There is a way in which we can all prevail and we can all survive and we can all do wonderfully well and we can transform this planet into a paradise. Imagine if we took all the defense budgets of every country in the world and used all of that for the betterment of all of us. How wondrous could the world be? Now, some people say that it's so naive, and yeah, it is naive. But I think you have to be naive to recognize how wondrous this world could be if we would simply shed this unrelenting capacity for slaughtering each other. Yes, that's where we need to go.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. Wonderfully said. Brian Green, it's been an absolute pleasure to get access to your thoughts and to your mind. And I do thank you for your generosity. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.